Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-3130, United States of America versus Delonta A. Reeves, appellant. Mr. Conte for the appellant, Ms. Fernley for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. This is a case where I believe that the actions of the counsel for the defendant down below muddied the record to the point that the district court was unable to correctly assess whether there was obstruction of justice. The record shows that the defendant was charged by way of a complaint and brought to the district court. Because of an apparent problem in the U.S. Attorney's Office, the case was dismissed and the client was released. Subsequent to the dismissal of the case was indicted. The only thing we know is that the other, his first defense counsel, advised the court that he had been advised that there was an arraignment date. That's the only thing in the record that indicates that the defendant, Mr. Reeves, had any indication whatsoever that he was required to come to court. And there was no court order that he come to court. And I think that's important because
this wasn't the argument in the district court, was it?
No, it was not.
So we're looking at this through the lens of plain error.
That's where I think that the actions of trial counsels have clouded this issue.
Well, that gets to your ineffective assistance of counsel claim. But we're looking at this through plain error, right?
I hate to concede that, and I won't concede it because
you won't.
Because he did make an objection.
But it wasn't this one.
It wasn't this one. But
and you say so in your brief quite forthrightly.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Okay.
But those actions again. Well, even if we address the plain error, if this court's going to listen to this under plain error statute, clearly it's error that its error affected his sentencing. The whole sentencing was predicated on facts that the trial court was not aware of.
Well, unless you're wrong that an order isn't required.
Pardon me?
Unless you're wrong that an order isn't required.
I'm not understanding the question.
Oh. Your argument is that there was no order for him to appear at the
That's event. Correct.
If you're wrong about that, then there's no error at all, much less plain error.
Well, there's no. Certainly, he was not ordered to return,
No, I'm saying if your argument is that there must be an order to return that he violates. That's not your argument.
No, my argument is that the trial courts needed the facts on which to predicate that. We have two cases, the Teta case and the Perry case. I think. They did find obstruction of justice where there wasn't an order to return to court. But I think the district court has to make that determination based on the correct set of facts. And if he didn't, then we're back into the ineffective assistance of counsel. The trial court was laboring under a totally erroneous set of facts as to the facts Mr. Reeves didn't appear in court. Trial court was not aware of that. It could have been totally different.
Trial court was not aware of what?
That the case had been dismissed and that there was no order to return to court. He was not under supervision.
But there was a superseding indictment, right?
No, the case was totally dismissed.
Well, let me say, that's what I haven't understood about this case. My notes, when I went over the chronology, is that there was a detention hearing April 3rd. Then there was a dismissal of the charges on April 27th. And then on May 2nd, there was a grand jury original indictment.
Correct.
Five counts.
That's correct.
And then May 30th, an arraignment was set for June 5.
Correct.
And what is it that the district court did not know?
The district court was not aware that he was under pretrial supervision, that the case had been dismissed in its entirety on 27 April.
I guess what I'm not clear on, and maybe counsel for the government can help me, is that there was an arraignment on May 30th after the grand jury original indictment.
The arraignment was scheduled for May 5th. It was the notice, there was a notice went out of the clerk's office.
Set for June 5th.
June 5th.
But there was, what happened on May 30th? That's when the arraignment was set.
Yes, that was just the clerk's office.
That was just the clerk's office.
Yes. They did send a notice out, mailed a notice.
Mailed notice to counsel.
Counsel and to the defendant. And that notice, as the government provided in their brief, is dated June 1st for a June 5th return date.
And what is it that you say the district court did not know?
That the case had been dismissed. He was under no judicial supervision as of the 27th.
All right, I'm going to ask counsel for the government about this. It's just factually something confusing.
Okay. Very well.
Thank you. Anything further?
No.
All right, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, April Fernley of the United States, joined by Elizabeth Trostman at counsel table, deputy chief for the appellate division, and David Sabolt, the AUSA, at the trial level. May it please the court, Judge Rogers, in terms of your question about what occurred on May 30th, the arraignment date was set by the clerk on that date. And the clerk sent a notice both to Delonta Reeves' address, and that is appended to the end of our brief, and that notice also instructed pretrial services and the attorney for Delonta Reeves to inform him of that date. That's when the June 5th date was then set. And on that date, when Delonta Reeves failed to appear, his counsel clearly told the court that he had been informed of that date, that they had had a phone conversation about that date, that Delonta Reeves had expressed concern and fear about coming to arraignment, and that his counsel had allayed those fears and instructed him that this was the date for arraignment.
So the June 1st notices were sent out electronically.
It is date stamped June 1st. Although it means that at the attachment one to our brief, the criminal notice just has the June 1st stamp on it.
So the docket doesn't indicate whether it was electronically sent. Just trying to be clear on that. Just trying to be clear what the district court knew at the time of sentencing.
Right. Well, this was never raised as a problem before the district court. So because we're on plain error, the district court didn't have a reason to delve into the question of whether.
Right, but his point is it's plain error if the district court had no basis in fact to increase the length of his sentence. So I just want to be clear what record was before the district court when he is trying to decide.
Before the district court had the pretrial, the sentencing report. And in the pre-sentence report, there was an explicit statement that the defendant had failed to appear as required, had willfully failed to appear for the arraignment date and had remained a fugitive for approximately 11 months. And the district court judge then adopted the factual assertions in the pretrial services pre-sentence report in the transcript on November 16, 2007, pages 3 and 4, and he said, other than the briefed issues, which included the weapon enhancement and the timing of the obstruction of justice, not whether obstruction of justice as a whole had occurred, other than those briefed issues that are in dispute, the judge said, I will accept the pre-sentence report as findings of fact. So the trial judge did, in fact, adopt those findings that there had been a willful failure to appear and that the defendant had remained a fugitive. And the trial judge repeated that in his findings, that those were the bases on which he was finding the obstruction of justice enhancement applicable. Certainly, if there were any time at which appellant could have, you know, raised this issue, I didn't know. His own sentencing proceeding, which took place over the course of two different days before the trial judge on November 16th and then continued until November 19th to further brief and consider the issues, that was the time at which the trial judge could have certainly been informed if there had been, there's never even to this date, even on this appeal, been any allegation that Delonta Reeves did not know about that hearing and did not willfully fail to appear before it. The real issue that counsel's raising now is, well, there was no court order for him to appear. And this court has never held that the obstruction of justice enhancement must be predicated on a court order, nor has any of the sister circuits that have considered obstruction of justice in the absence of a court order required a court order. For instance, the court in Teta, which is the Seventh Circuit case, held that a defendant who'd been told about his arraignment date by the court clerk after he failed to appear for his first date, that could constitute obstruction of justice when he then failed to appear for that date. So what happened is the defendant called the court, had said, I went to the wrong courthouse, I went to Madison instead of Milwaukee, and the court clerk gave him a new arraignment date. He said, all right, come on August 4th, 1989. And that defendant didn't come on August 4th, 1989, and alleged before the trial court, well, I thought the court clerk gave me the date of August 11th, 1989.
We're just clear on my point. The argument that he was not under supervision is just a red herring.
There's a lack of clarity in the record as to what occurred on the date that the case was technically dismissed, because there's a reference in the pretrial services report that says Mr. Reeves became a loss of contact during a particular, that they lost contact with Delonta Reeves for a particular date period. And it's not clear why pretrial services was continuing to monitor him when technically the case had been dismissed. It may have been that they hadn't received notice because the dismissal period was quite short. It was dismissed on April 27th, and the indictment was filed. It was dismissed on a Thursday, and then the indictment was filed on a Tuesday. So there were really only a couple of business days in there. So it may have been that that's why they continued to supervise. It's just not clear why they did. But in fact, in the pre-sentence report, it stated that pretrial lost contact with Delonta Reeves on the very date that the arraignment had been set by the court. So in the pre-sentence report, it says that pretrial lost contact with him on May 30th, 2006. And that's the date that his counsel informed the district court that he had called his counsel, that he had called his client. He said, as soon as I received notice from the court, which was on May 30th, 2006, I called Delonta Reeves and we had this conversation. So there's sort of a further inference that can be taken that, you know, the loss of contract with pretrial took place in the same day that the counsel had conveyed the arraignment date to the appellant. And there's some further evidence that supports that, which is then there's a lack of contact between appellant and the court or his counsel for about a year. And then his rearrest is again in the same block, distributing narcotics, which is the same offense type that he was arrested for originally. So there certainly was a plethora of factors that the district court had to rely upon in deciding that there had been obstruction based on the failure to come to court and then the failure to come back to court once he'd failed to come. So in this case, the government believes there was no error. At the very least, there was certainly no plain error because everything before the district court suggested and was obstruction. There was the only debate going on before the district court was the timing of the obstruction. The issue that appellant was raising below was, well, the obstruction in this case took place before the plea agreement. And for that reason, we don't think Your Honor should increase the sentence on the basis of that pre-plea agreement obstruction. There was never the argument, and actually there was no obstruction. Nothing like that was ever raised. It was all sort of a foregone conclusion, and the timing was the issue that was being discussed. So for that reason, the government believes there's certainly no error and no plain error. And furthermore, as a result, there was also no error in the court declining to grant the third point of acceptance of responsibility points because in an instance where there is obstruction, the court need not even grant the first 2 points, but the court even found this was a more extraordinary. He was going to permit the acceptance in an extraordinary circumstance, finding that once he returned and began his court proceedings again, that he did accept responsibility fairly quickly. But the court went against both the government and defense counsel's recommendation for the third point and said, but I just can't take that extra leap in saying this was especially timely or that it saved resources for the court or the government.
The government did file the motion here to reduce by one level.
Yes, right? The government did.
And does the court actually have the discretion to, under the new amendment, to ignore the government's motion?
I do believe that the court does have discretion, and the court actually stated to the parties on multiple occasions that despite your plea agreement, that it had discretion. In fact,
we haven't decided that question, have we? I mean, some circuits say yes, some circuits say no.
Oh, I see your point. All right, I guess I'm not certain as to whether there's would be a preclusion of that. My understanding was that in the absence of any particular ruling, that the court still had full discretion as to whether to adopt the recommendations in the plea agreement. And the judge specifically addresses that in the November 16, 2007 transcript at pages 14 to 15, where he says, despite the fact the government's asking for the third point of acceptance of responsibility, that's still my decision. At least that was the trial judge's understanding of it, and mine as well, absent any sort of clear authority to the contrary. Given that the obstruction was proper and that it was properly based on factual findings in the record, and the third point also was proper in its denial, there was certainly no deficiency on counsel's part to raise an argument that had no ultimate merit. For those reasons, the government would ask the court to affirm the judgment and sentence of the district court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant.
There was no case existent once the magistrate's case was dismissed. It's not even mentioned in the pre-sentence report. The district court did not have all the facts necessary to make the decision on the obstruction of justice. It's just void of that one very important fact. I concede that the court may have denied or may have granted the those points if it knew all the facts. The point is that the trial judge didn't have all the facts on which to make that decision. And for those reasons, this case should be remanded to the district court so that all the facts can be presented for him and he can make the ultimate decision. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Conte, you were appointed by the court, and I want to express our appreciation for the assistance you've provided.
Thank you.